after several years of exile, and ends on the anniversary of the victory of the revolution. As of every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. Located south of the capital, Tehran, the mausoleum hosts senior Iranian officials as well as ordinary people, especially on the first day of the celebrations.
Like every year, we came here in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country, a man who led Iranians toward their ideals.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. People sought to establish a new political system that was based on their will and Islamic values, and that was the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic means that a Muslim nation like Iran needs to have an Islamic constitution and an Islamic lifestyle. During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us, something which was not accepted by our people.
To me, as a person who has not seen the revolution, such ceremonies can help acquaint me with the character of Imam Khomeini and what led Iranians to rise against the Shah.
This year, authorities in charge of the 10-day ceremonies say no mass gatherings will be allowed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Instead of public celebrations, Mehrabad Airport hosted a motorcycle parade by Iran's armed forces. Through the route Imam Khomeini took from the airport in 1979, as millions of people flocked to the streets to welcome him.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence. Those voices have echoed through the decades and have been heard by different generations. This year, the occasion is marked without mass celebrations amid the coronavirus pandemic. But organizers say the message is the same. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Protesters have taken to the streets in dozens of French cities against a security bill they say will restrict the filming and publicizing of images of police brutality. Demonstrators said the draft legislation will lead to more censorship and less freedom.
This bill has one objective, to allow a surveillance of the territory by drones. We are, of course, against the ban for journalists to film and to publish pictures of police officers. They want to prevent the publication of footage of police violence. The citizens say we don't want this law at all.
A total of 70 groups, including the Yellow Vests, organized a protest. Protesters said the new law opens the door to a generalized surveillance of the population, the use of drones, and the ban to film police officers.
We have been experiencing police violence for a long time, in the suburbs more than elsewhere. There is more and more violence during demonstrations. The citizens should understand that we are here to defend their future liberty and the right to film. We must be able to show the judges that sometimes there is police violence. Pictures are sometimes the only evidence.
Footage of white police officers beating up a black music producer in his Paris studio on November 21 has fueled anger over the legislation, condemned by many as signaling a swing to the right by President Emmanuel Macron.
We've got for a lot of years now in France a lot of discussions about identity checks, which are very more likely to be happening to young people, to men, and to men with different backgrounds from origin, Arabic people and black people. So this kind of systematic background checks and identity checks, it participates to a state racism in French, especially about the police, and so we are fully supporting the Amnesty report.
Last week, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and four other rights groups warned that they will file a lawsuit against the French government for what they called systematic discrimination by police officers carrying out identity checks. Even French President Macron admitted recently that there was a problem of discrimination during identity checks.
The new security bill will be debated in the French Senate in about 1 month. Some senators declared they want to rewrite the bill, but most protesters here simply want to abrogate it. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
The government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has come under fire after International Corruption Perceptions Index slipped Pakistan by 4 points. It has come as an embarrassment for a government which came into power in 2018 with a key promise to bring an end to the rampant corruption in Pakistan. Prime Minister Imran Khan argued that the data given in the Transparency International report belonged to the period when the opposition parties were in power, something denied by the opposition.
The date given in the findings of Transparency International is of 2019 and 2020. The data reveals that Pakistan, in fact, has slipped by 7 points since this government came into power. It indicates that this government has not only turned out to be the most incompetent, but also the most corrupt government Pakistan ever had.
The Transparency International's Perception Index ranked Pakistan at 124th position out of 180 countries.
As a result of our movement against the menace of corruption, now there is more awareness and discussions against corruption. Something never happened before in Pakistan. And the Transparency International report is based on perception about corruption, and obviously the report has led to affect Pakistan's global standing.
Most of the MPs, ministers and advisors of the current government joined the ruling party not long before general elections in 2018. A significant number of them from the opposition parties, and many among them were tainted with the corruption charges.
Public perception in Pakistan is that Prime Minister Imran Khan himself is not financially corrupt, unlike many of his predecessors. However, media reports indicate that many of his close associates were allegedly involved in wheeling and dealing in a country where anti-graft watchdog least punish allegedly corrupt officials, ministers, advisors, and powerful retired military generals. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says it is the duty of the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and fulfill its obligations under the accord. In a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart, Zarif underlined that the moment the United States fulfills its commitments, Iran would be prepared to fulfill ours.
It is the duty of the United States to return to this agreement and to fulfill its obligations. The moment the United States fulfills its commitments, we would prepare to fulfill ours.
Zarif also denounced a U.S. decision last month to slap sanctions on Turkey over the country's purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense system. He said the sanctions have no significance. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zarif hailed relations with Turkey, noting that ties will deepen when the U.S. adopts more reasonable attitudes. For his part, Cavusoglu said Turkey has always supported the nuclear deal, expressing the hope that the Biden administration would return to the JCPOA and lift sanctions on Iran.
I hope that with the Biden administration, the United States' return to this agreement and cooperation on the nuclear issue is restored. In this way, God willing, the sanctions and embargoes imposed on brotherly Iran are lifted.
Zarif arrived in Turkey as part of a tour of countries of the South Caucasus aimed at building support for the creation of a regional platform that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and encourage cooperation between the countries. The initiative was proposed following a ceasefire agreement in November that halted weeks of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I think the meeting was very important. Both sides have a lot in common and many issues were discussed regionally and economically. The most important issue on the agenda was the Iran nuclear deal. And now with the new U.S. administration, there is a hope for this deal to be revived.
Zarif also met with Turkish President Erdogan, where the two discussed expansion of bilateral ties, as well as regional cooperation in Syria, Iraq, Caucasus, and ways to restore stability in the region through synergy. This meeting is seen by many as a door to open negotiations between Turkey and the U.S. to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Public and private sector workers staged a nationwide 24-hour general strike to denounce government measures adopted to counter the spread of coronavirus disease in Italy. The industrial action, called by the Confederation of Base Unions COBAS, was joined by public servants and self-employed workers in several cities, including Milan, Rome, and Naples. In a note, unions have explained that the ongoing health crisis has exacerbated a structural crisis of the capitalist economy, with a generalized impoverishment and a worsening of living conditions for millions of male and female workers. Also, students and teachers of Italian high schools held rallies in Rome and other cities, demanding a prompt return to the classroom after almost 10 months of remote learning.
We are staging a protest to reiterate that schools must be a priority in this country. Just a small amount of the recovery fund is destined to the school system. Students are sick and tired of distance learning and are dropping out of schools. Many are falling victim to depression.
Students across Italy have been holding demonstrations, open-air lessons and strikes in protest over the adoption of the distance learning policy by the government in response to a second wave of COVID-19 in October. About 10 million students have been affected by coronavirus restrictions in Italy, while schools have remained open in most European countries.
We demand more classrooms, transport to school and better access to education. Distance learning is not working. Many families cannot afford providing digital devices to their children to attend internet lessons regularly. Our families get poorer by the day as our parents lose their jobs.
As if the COVID crisis and its grave effects on the Italians weren't enough, Italy has also been hit by a political crisis, with Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigning earlier this week, forcing the country's head of state to start a round of formal consultations with all political groups to establish if a new government majority can be formed.
Talks between Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and party leaders to resolve the government crisis concluded on Friday, with the country on the brink of a crashing socio-economic failure. President Mattarella must now decide on the way forward and ensure Italy a new government. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli occupation has denied COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israeli parliament said Palestinians living under Israeli blockade in the Gaza Strip will receive no vaccine. Palestinians say the move is aimed at pressurizing resistance groups to release Israeli soldiers arrested during the Israeli aggression imposed against the Strip since 2014.
Israel's aggressive policies are unacceptable, and Palestinians will resist these inhumane policies. The Israeli announcement to deny vaccines to Gaza is totally unacceptable. The resistance groups will remain steadfast in their fight against the occupation and have prepared themselves for all possible scenarios.
This comes as Israeli Health Ministry has said over a quarter of Israel's population have received the vaccine since December 19. Human rights groups have accused Israeli regime of violating the basic rights of Palestinians.
Since the coronavirus outbreak in the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime has sought through all possible means to pressurize the resistance groups into sitting back. Israel has announced that no aid is allowed in the Gaza Strip without the release of their captured soldiers. Palestinians will never accept such a thing, and the Israeli occupation knows this well. Israel is now showing its racist face to the world by announcing this illegal and inhumane policy.
For their own part, Palestinian resistance groups in the Strip have said they will not sit back, adding release of Israeli soldiers should come through a just prisoner swap deal.
We announced that the Israeli attempts to pressurize the resistance front into releasing its captured soldiers won't succeed. We are after a fair swap deal. We won't give in to pressure. Israel's attempts to tie vaccine entrance to soldier release will fail.
Earlier, the United Nations called on the Israeli regime to help ensure Palestinians will receive COVID-19 vaccinations amid the coronavirus pandemic, stressing that the pandemic has taken a heavy toll on the occupied Palestinian territories. The UN said the cost of lives and livelihoods there remain high.
particularly in the Gaza Strip.
Israel's move to deny vaccine to the Palestinians comes as over 156,000 Palestinians have been infected with coronavirus and more than 1,800 have lost their lives so far. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain is speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The debate.
Iran has hosted the political leader of Afghanistan's Taliban, offering Tehran's input in peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government, talks that have been stalled in Qatar. The Taliban does not recognize the current government headed by Ashraf Ghani, to the Western influence, in particular by the U.S. In this edition of the debate, we'll look at how this deadlock can be resolved, one in which the Taliban wants the ouster of all U.S. and foreign forces from the country.
Insecurity and violence continue unabated in Afghanistan. The most recent attack happened on January 30th when a bomber drove his explosive-laden vehicle into a military base in the eastern province of Nangarhar. Official reports said 8 security personnel were killed in the attack, but local sources put the toll at 15. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the bombing. A few weeks before that incident, unidentified gunmen opened fire on a vehicle carrying employees of the Supreme Court during the morning rush hour in northern Kabul. No group claimed responsibility for that attack, which killed 2 female judges. Violence has picked up once again in Afghanistan in recent months, especially in Kabul. But who is really to blame for the rising insecurity in the country? Both the Taliban and the United States accuse each other of not complying with the terms of an agreement they signed in February last year to bring peace to the war-weary nation. The Taliban said the United States violates last year's agreement, with one of its spokesmen saying the U.S. is bombarding civilian gatherings and residential areas in Afghanistan. The group argues that the attacks not only breached the agreement, but also constitute a grave violation of human rights. Washington, however, blames the Taliban for not meeting its commitments under the deal. The Pentagon says it's very hard to see a way forward for a negotiated settlement if the group does not fulfill its obligations. Under last year's deal, Washington vowed to withdraw all coalition forces under its command from Afghanistan. In return, the Taliban agreed to give some security guarantees, among them not allowing extremists to operate in the country. Now, with the new U.S. administration coming into play, Washington is expected to pursue a different policy in Afghanistan. President Joe Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, says the U.S. will review the peace agreement with the Taliban. Many believe the United States is seeking to maintain its presence in Afghanistan for good.
Well, it's a no-win situation for Washington. The Taliban must know that that the Americans will not recommit more troops. That's almost certainly the case, that they won't go back with more troops, and that they won't be there forever.
despite the fact that its war and ensuing occupation have inflicted heavy damages to the Afghan people.
It is very important for the countries of the region to sort out their problems without an outside interference. This is what is pushing Iran to support the Afghan internal talk between the Taliban and the Afghani government, regardless what the role of the U.S. Government can be.
But with all the mistrust between the Taliban and the United States, one should think of the role neighboring countries could play in that regard. All in all, it seems that regional countries can have an important role in bringing nearly 20 years of U.S. occupation to an end in Afghanistan and support talks between various groups for an inclusive government.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the debate. Peace advocate and political activist Fashal Barakat joins us from New York. We also have journalist and political commentator Sid Mohsen Abbas joining us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Fashal Barakat, let me first start with you. We're looking at peace talks that have been going on for quite some time. At this point, it has been stalled. But it's kind of strange when you talk about peace talks, and yet you have, on the one hand, how the U.S. is positioning itself and posturing itself, and yet, on the other hand, you have the Taliban doing the same, but still violence is occurring in the country. What is your impression of what's happening and why the talks have stalled?
I think the talks were stalled because it was predictable that they, in fact, would stall as soon as it became clear that Donald Trump was defeated in the election and that the Biden administration was coming to power. There have been reports that suggested that there were back channel communications between elements inside the Biden campaign and members of the Afghan government to ensure the Afghan government that if the Biden administration was to come to power, that there would be a review of the so-called peace process with the likelihood that some way will be found to continue some kind of U.S. presence in that country. So it was quite predictable that this was going to happen. There have been maneuvers on both sides to create certain realities on the ground, both militarily and, of course, politically. And I think that will continue until it becomes clear where this administration really stands and what kind of pressure can be put on the administration to maintain some kind of commitment to extricating the U.S. from a two-decade-long quagmire.
And when you look at that time frame that was just mentioned there, Sid Mohsen Abbas, 2 decades, you take a look at the way that the U.S. is conducting itself in this peace talks, and remember distinctly, it was months ago when the Taliban actually injured some U.S. soldiers, and yet the U.S. continued having talks with the Taliban. I mean, is that pretty much the level that the U.S. has stooped itself to after 19, 20 years of being in that country, even if it's having its U.S. soldiers being injured, that's continuing the talks?
There are many reasons why America won't necessarily leave Afghanistan completely. The resources that exist in Afghanistan are one. You know, General Petraeus, when he was lurking in that region, was hailing $1 trillion worth of natural resources under Afghanistan. A different question how you get those resources out, but certainly that temptation of the resources within Afghanistan is one factor which often goes unsaid, but it's certainly still there. And also, of course, the negotiations should have given us a hint as well back on September 15th last year, because the representatives of the Taliban and the Afghan government gathered in Doha, Qatar, as you will recall. They met face-to-face. Peace negotiations looked like they were underway. The foreign leaders attending in person and by video conference lauded the start of that peace conference and the talks as a historic moment. But it was interesting to note at that time the Taliban's reaction, which was far more subdued. Their senior negotiator was Maulvi Abdullah Hakim Haqqani, and he sat punched in his chair in Grand Ballroom hardly looking at the video screen and even refused to put the translation headset on. So, you know, perhaps the Taliban had a point at that time. They were very wary of any American promises. They're very well known to break most of the promises they make. And the history of intrastate wars is littered with failed peace attempts. Since World War II, nearly three quarters of the insurgencies have ended because of a military victory by a government or an insurgent side on the battlefield. And only a quarter have ended because of a political negotiation or other factors. Afghanistan itself is a graveyard of failed peace talks. We all know that.
Let's look at, if we can, one of the biggest stumbling blocks that exists in these talks, Jean Mubaraka, and that is the fact that the Taliban does not recognize the government headed by Ashraf Ghani, and yet you have this being a government that is accepted by the international community. How can this peace be resolved?
Well, that's a very difficult challenge, and I think the way the Trump administration dealt with that challenge was to, in essence, sideline the Afghan government. I think beyond the Western European and various Western European, U.S. vassal states, most people recognized that the Afghan government lacked real credibility, that it was a government that was seen by the Taliban as basically a front for U.S. power. And I think most people in the world saw it in the same light. So it's going to be very difficult for the Biden administration to execute a peace agreement when they have to pretend that they want to bring in and have as a full partner this Afghan government. Everybody knows that it's the day after the U.S. Reduces or eliminates its material support and political support for that government, it will collapse. So it's a very daunting challenge to continue the charade of a legitimate government in Kabul and a serious attempt to try to execute a real agreement, which means you have to deal with the forces on the ground who have the power. In this case, that is the Taliban.
Well, Simhasan Abbas, you talked about how, and this is not a surprise, and it's not new news, that the Taliban wants U.S. forces and Western forces out of the country, period. Now, according to reports, the deal that the Trump administration made, headed by Salman Khalilzad, with the Taliban was that the U.S. forces were supposed to leave the country by the month of April. Is that accurate? I mean, you know, the details are somewhat, if not at least a bit murky, about what happened as to the reasons why the deal fell apart. And for the Taliban at this point to be hosting right now, hosted in Iran, in order to see if Iran can give its input in the matter.
I think the Trump administration or the people negotiating this deal would have known that it was very, very, touch and go. There was no guarantee that Donald Trump was going to come back into power. All the polls were against him. I think everybody had a pretty good idea that there was going to be a strong chance that anything that he wrote wasn't really worth the paper it was written on in terms of a deal. So I think that it's why I think nobody was really taking it terribly seriously. But of course, the idea of a deal succeeding, and the likes of Iran and Russia and Pakistan, all the neighboring nations, actually has to be pursued. And the Americans shouldn't be the main arbiters. They shouldn't arbitrators. They shouldn't be the main, if you like, reason whether an agreement is reached or not. The regional powers have a far, better chance of achieving a peace because it's in their interest to have peace in their own backyards. The Americans don't have that interest. They were there primarily under the guise of fighting a war on terror, were actually just there to occupy geopolitically a country which allows them to put pressure on Iran to the west, allows them to keep a hold on Pakistan to some extent, on the east as well, and also to pose a threat to Russia itself up in the north. And of course, you know that the Americans are not very happy about the Chinese building up this Silk Road. So again, Afghanistan sits right on the middle of that road between Pakistan and Iran and further north. So all of these issues geopolitically for the Americans make it absolutely vital that they keep their foot in the door, either by keeping a government that's their own puppet, or to get, for instance, India to have a greater role in Afghanistan, which they actually really were trying to do. India had around 30 consulates at one stage in Afghanistan, and they were really partnering America as the possible regional power that would prop up Afghanistan, maintain American interests, and also keep Pakistan and Iran at bay within Afghanistan. So a lot of games were going on. Of course, ending this is vital also for the simple reason that the Americans, since they've been there, have overseen the killing of 157,000 people, including 43,000 civilians, as a conservative estimate. They've created massive suffering amongst the population, decimated its economy, and it would also really be an opportunity for them to save face, to get out while they can, because they've lost 2,500 or so troops as well, and really they've got far bigger problems to deal with COVID-19 at home, and the likes of China and Russia pressing them from all angles in terms of economic rise. They'd be far better placed to actually, you know, give up the ghost in Afghanistan. You can never control a country from a distance that they're doing, and you can never maintain it. It won't happen. So they need to find another kind of another strategy here.
Focusing on the government again here, if I may ask you, Ashim Mubarak, that when Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif hosted this delegation that came from Afghanistan, he highlighted the need for the launch of what's called this Afghan-Afghan talks, formation of an all-inclusive government, something the Taliban also has emphasized and highlighted. Iran saying, furthermore, that it was ready to take part in efforts aimed at this peace process that would be with the participation of Kabul and all Afghan political forces. What are the stumbling blocks there? Is that a feasible solution or something that can be attained?
Stumbling block is the role of the Iranians. This is something that the U.S. is not going to. Well, the U.S. is opposed to seeing more Iranian influence in the area, in that area, and therefore that possibility is somewhat slim. Now it can happen, but as your other guests indicated, there's some serious and powerful forces that want to see the U.S. to maintain a physical presence in that part of the world, even if it means that they won't be able to completely control the entire Afghan state. If they can cut a deal to maintain a physical presence, I think that they will. We keep in mind that the Taliban has always indicated that they wanted to have some kind of normalized relations with the U.S. for quite some time, even before the attack. So, you know, there's a possibility of something that could be, some deal that could be cut that would give, create a government of national unity, but also allow, under the pretext of security assistance and fighting so-called terrorism, for some U.S. presence, both military presence officially and their private military contractors.
Okay, well, Mohsen Abbas, you know, we could talk about all the different factors involved here with the peace process that has started, that is now stalled. But really, if it comes down to it, the Taliban has made it very clear, and it's pretty simple if you look at it. They're not going to negotiate with this current government because they feel like it's influenced by the U.S. and the Western countries. They have made it very clear they want foreign forces out of the country. I'm guessing along with that, they want, for example, U.S. bases not to exist there anymore. And along with that, they control 70% of the country. So what kind of leverage does the U.S. have in these talks?
It's an increasingly weakening one, and we know off the record that Pakistan's intelligence services and Pakistan itself has a strong interest in probably not really allowing the Americans to have a long-term foothold, because the region is changing. Pakistan was previously got a lot of money to control Afghanistan, or at least certainly to influence it heavily over the last couple of decades, went along with American policies for a long time. And it seems though now that increasingly the emergence of China, the Belt Road, the whole CPEC, and Gwadar port connection, which the Chinese have got with Pakistan, is influencing the Pakistanis more and more, and they're actually much more reluctant to go along with American plans for that region, and that the least of all they would want is Afghanistan to become a hostile nation, which the current government actually is, more or less. It's not really friendly with them. They won't want that government staying there. They certainly therefore hold the cards with the Taliban to continue that that hold. The Islamic Republic of Iran is not going to trust the Americans with its US-based propensity to threaten Iran, nor are the Russians. So nobody actually around that region wants the Americans there, because they know they've got a malign intent. There's no really positive, you know, infrastructure building in a real sense. All they've been doing is trying to build the security apparatus and get the government to be able to stand up on its own feet. They failed at that miserably. And what's worse now is that actually also the suspicion is that ISIS fighters from Syria, Iraq, and other places have been ferried in or flown in or smuggled into Afghanistan, particularly. And the allegation is that the Americans are also involved in this on a covert basis to throw in another, if you like, wild card into Afghanistan. They can't control the Taliban. The government is too weak. So they would need some sort of insurance policy for another wild card like the ISIS jihadists, if you like, to come in and cause mayhem and murder. And they've been doing that. They've been disrupting a lot of the situation there in and around Kabul and other areas. So there are many players, and it's a very complex situation. I think, obviously, for the people, the interest is to resolve the issues, come to a compromise. I rather feel it's going to be more complicated than that.
Well, you have a new incoming administration that is now in the White House there, Ajama Baraka, headed by the U.S. President Joe Biden, who has said that he's going to review the Afghanistan file and is not sure whether what was reached, the deal that was reached by Trump, is actually a good deal. We're seeing already posturing there. We also had, if I may put these two together, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council saying that the U.S. is looking to stay even longer in the country now that the U.S. President is Joe Biden. Do you think the U.S. is looking to extend its stay in Afghanistan?
You know, for all the reasons that your guest just laid out, one would think that objectively to pursue that kind of policy would be irrational. But we have seen in the last few decades a pursuit of U.S. foreign policy that, in fact, has defied rationality. Yes, I do believe that there are forces in the foreign policy community that would like to see a physical presence maintained in Afghanistan. Will they be successful in maintaining that that presence? Well, that remains to be seen. I don't think so, especially if there is a stronger peace movement in the United States of America. But I think in the short term, it's quite clear that the Biden administration has been making moves that appear to suggest that they're going to find a way to not have to withdraw U.S. troops past May 1st and to try to galvanize public support to maintain support for the presence of the U.S. using the excuse, I believe, of security, of terrorist threats, stability, supposedly, to maintain a U.S. presence in that part of the world. So, yes.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much for that. Peace advocate and political activist Ajama Baraka from New York, and thank you, journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas from London. And that is for this edition of The Debate. From Mika Vitale, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Donald Trump has named new lawyers to lead the defense at his impeachment trial in the Senate next week, under charge that he unleashed a deadly insurrection upon the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January. The announcement comes just a day after his previous legal team fell apart. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Tom McCarthy and Joanna Walters. The piece is titled, Donald Trump Hires New Impeachment Defense Team After Lead Lawyers Quit. Stay with us for more of Tom McCarthy and Joanna Walters' article. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has named new lawyers to lead the defense at his impeachment trial in the Senate next week, under charge that he unleashed a deadly insurrection upon the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January. The announcement comes just a day after his previous legal team fell apart. Trial lawyer David Schoen and Bruce Castor will head up Donald Trump's new legal team, the former U.S. president announced on Sunday evening, 31st of January. The ability of Republican senators who plan to acquit Donald Trump to weigh the case on the merits remained challenged, however, after the mass resignation of Trump's previous legal team and the looming Senate deadline of Tuesday to submit a preliminary memo laying out his defense. The House impeached Donald Trump earlier this month on a single article charging incitement of insurrection, a historic second impeachment of a U.S. president. The new lawyers are not without controversy. David Schoen represented Roger Stone, who was convicted in November of 2019 of obstructing a congressional investigation into whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to win the 2016 presidential election, and then had his prison sentence commuted by Donald Trump. The Atlanta-based lawyer, David Schoen, also met with sex offender Jeffrey Epstein when the financier was preparing for trial in New York on charges relating to sexual exploitation, and shortly before Jeffrey Epstein died in prison in 2019. Bruce Castor, who is also heading the Trump legal team, is a former acting attorney general of Pennsylvania and a prominent Republican who has been slammed by advocates for victims of sexual crimes because of his stance against reforms involving past victims of sexual violence. Trump's new team will have very little time to prepare for the impeachment trial. according to a schedule hammered out by leaders from both parties. House prosecutors were to respond to Donald Trump's defense memo, after which arguments were to begin on the Senate floor on 9th of February. But the trial schedule and its substance have been thrown into doubt with the departure of five lawyers on Trump's defense team, apparently the entire legal team. The resignations were first reported by CNN, which said the lawyers and Donald Trump disagreed over strategy. A Trump spokesperson told the New York Times that there had been a strategy disagreement, but denied it was over Donald Trump's insistence that his defense center under wild false accusations of election fraud that he had been peddling for months. Those false accusations drew Trump supporters, many affiliated with anti-government groups and white supremacist groups, to Washington on Wednesday, 6th of January, to contest the certification by Congress of Joe Biden's victory, the supporters later told law enforcement. After Trump encouraged the group in a speech to march onto the Capitol building, they broke into the building and vandalized it, killed a police officer and injured dozens of people, trampled a woman to death, and caused three additional deaths, not counting two additional police officers who later died by suicide. In a sense, the resignation of Trump's lawyers was irrelevant because Republicans are planning to acquit Donald Trump in any case, observed Princeton University historian Julian Zelizer. The crisis over Donald Trump's legal team quitting assumes that the substance of the impeachment case will sway Senate Republicans, Zelizer tweeted. Most already have their answer. Trump could offer no defense, or he can go onto the floor of the Senate to read lines from the Joker movie. They would still vote to acquit him. Speaking on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday morning, Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman, who announced last week that he will not seek re-election, indicated that any notion of Donald Trump basing his defense in his second impeachment trial on a claim that he actually won the November election rather than a constitutionality argument will not benefit him. Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman noted that there was not adequate evidence of fraud to change the election result from a victory for Joe Biden, and that was the view of the Trump Department of Justice too. We need to be very clear to the American people. We have to acknowledge that last November's election was lost, and we have to move on, Portman said. Joe Biden was duly elected. Donald Trump's former legal team, which had been led by South Carolina attorney Butch Bowers, appeared to be crafting a defense that would have challenged the constitutionality of trying a president after he has left office. The team was also expected to argue that Donald Trump's speech was covered by the First Amendment on free speech and did not constitute incitement. In a vote last week, 45 out of 50 Republican senators backed a resolution supporting the argument that it would be unconstitutional to try a former president. Most constitutional scholars disagree sharply, saying there is clear historic precedent for trying defendants who have left office, and indeed, Trump was still in office when he was impeached. The departure of Butch Bowers and Deborah Barbary, two South Carolina lawyers, was described by a source familiar with the situation as a mutual decision. Three other lawyers associated with the team, Josh Howard of North Carolina and Johnny Gasser and Greg Harris of South Carolina, also parted ways with Donald Trump, according to another source. The Democrats' effort to impeach a president who has already left office is totally unconstitutional and so bad for our country, said Jason Miller, a Donald Trump advisor.
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.